Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument for petitioner in Unirol v. Martinez.
May it please the court, Mr. John Kyle will present argument for petitioner.
May it please the court. This is a products liability case. My client, Unirol Goodrich Tire Company, the petitioner in this case, which we refer to as Goodrich, makes tires designed to fit on wheels that are manufactured by other people, but designed only to fit on the size of the tire, the size of the tire matching the size of the wheel. We do not make wheels, only tires. In this case, the respondent attempted to fit a 16-inch tire manufactured by my client onto a 16.5-inch metal wheel manufactured by one of the settling defendants. This is an obvious misuse of the tire. It was never meant to be used on a 16.5-inch wheel.
Was there evidence that a 16-inch tire came off the truck?
There was some evidence of that, Your Honor. What the evidence basically was that these two men had been out there and that there were four or five or six tires, one on a truck, it was on an old trailer actually, behind the building they'd been working on. And they had taken several tires and wheels off, and some of them had been 16-inch, yes. There also were pictures, however, 16.5-inch wheels back there. So the testament was they thought they had taken a 16-inch tire off of this particular wheel, but it was very vague as to whether they actually knew for sure that they had. This obvious misuse of the tire had been warned against by Goodrich, specifically warned against using a 16-inch tire on a 16.5-inch wheel, and specifically warning and instructing people who change tires how to go about it in a particular manner. This is a portion of the warning sticker which appeared on the tire. And in addition to warning not to put a 16 or 16.5, it very specifically tells the person who's changing the tire, gives them specific instructions which apply not only to making sure you have a 16-inch tire on a 16.5-inch wheel, not making sure you don't have that, but also it applies to all types of tire changing procedures that will keep a person who's changing tires from being injured. The result of this fact situation presents to the court the legal issue of a manufacturer with a product that is perfectly safe for its ordinary use, but that the manufacturers become aware of a few instances of misuse of the tire, and they're further faced with the fact that no engineering change in the tire can prevent the misuse from occurring, and they're further faced with the ability to put a warning on there. By the way, the Court of Appeals acknowledged that they could not prevent the misuse from occurring by any engineering change in the design of the tire.
An engineering change could not prevent the misuse.
That's
but,
correct.
If I recall, isn't there the possibility that an engineering change could have prevented this accident from happening with a different type of, I think it was bead that was used?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'll get into that in just a minute when I get a little bit further into the facts of the case, but the plaintiff's expert's testimony was that by using a heftier bead, you would reduce the number of these accidents because the number of pounds per square inch that it would take to break that other bead would be somewhat higher. It's still going to break at some point, which I'll get into in a minute, but their contention is therefore it reduces the risk. Our position, of course, is that that's like a guard on any type of machine you have. Let's say you have a meat slicer in the grocery store and you have to put a guard on it because everybody says it's safer with a guard on there, and you warn them and say, now don't take this guard off of there. But if one manufacturer has two bolts in the guard and the other one has four, somebody's always going to argue that, well, if you put four bolts on there, it's going to take longer to take that guard off of there, so it's going to reduce the number of instances where they're going to misuse the meat slicer. It's going to reduce the number of times that somebody's going to get hurt with it. But it's still perfectly safe with two on there.
What would have been the drawback to putting the better bead in there?
Well, I would question, of course, use of the word better, but there are a couple of drawbacks to it. One is that since, let me get into this. I'm going to explain to the court in just a moment the process that the tire changer goes through. This bottom photograph shows a tire on the wrong size rim. That is, this is 16 and a half inch rim with a 16 inch tire on it. And the bead is this little piece of metal that is a hoop inside the rim of the tire. If you have the wrong size, that metal bead does not stretch. It never stretches. It can't. It's designed not to stretch. Because if it stretched, it'd come off the wheel and you'd come off the wheel driving down the road. If you make it a little bit heftier, there's two problems that causes. One is, since it's never going to stretch, it's always going to break at some PSI when the tire changer gets enough air in it. In this case, the man was not using a gauge, so he never knew how much air he had in it. He's going to go to 50, 100, 150, whatever he goes to, until he thinks it fits, and it's never going to fit. At some point, it's still going to break. So the first problem you have is if you put a little heftier bead in there is, when it does break in front of that tire changer, it's going to cause a larger explosion than the slightly less hefty bead would. More importantly, if he stops thinking he's got some kind of a fit, even though he really doesn't, let's say he stops at 100 PSI, and he thinks he's got some kind of a fit, he puts that on a vehicle, that tire is going to fall apart within a few hundred miles. And it may fall apart in front of the school bus, in front of the church van, in front of who knows what. But the evidence was clear that down the road that tire is going to fall apart because it's not a fit, it's not made to fit, and it will never fit.
So their argument that the alternative bead is not a viable option?
Our argument, John?
Their argument that
it is a viable argument, doesn't it? Well, our position is that it is not viable for several reasons, for those that I just gave, plus the fact that if you follow these instructions, you won't ever get to that stage no matter which bead you use. And neither bead is safe if it's mismatched.
But is this a decision for a court to make, or does a fact finder have to make it? Well, in other words, if it can be shown that another design would have prevented this accident, occasion, but it might cause some accident on some other occasion, does the court make those kind of judgment calls as a matter of law, or do we just look if there's some evidence that another design could have prevented this evidence?
Well,
prevented this accident, then we are bound to uphold the judgment.
There might be a fact issue as to whether, on a particular set of facts, this bead they're claiming was an alternative might have, quote-unquote, prevented that accident, depending on how much air pressure the guy got in on that occasion. Our position is it's not a fact question before this court, because as a matter of law, we have a warning in place that says if you follow these warnings and these instructions, no matter which bead you use, nothing's going to happen to you.
Your position is that the warning defeats the design defect claim.
If, Your Honor, if they never contest the warning. Our position is basically that, number one, you know, even in a design defect case, you have to talk about warning, because the plaintiff's entitled to show that either there's no warning there, or the one that there's no good. And the defense entitled to show, we have a good warning on this device, and we have reasons for not changing to this alternative, you say, and this warning will prevent you from getting hurt, just like in the meat slicer case.
Well, forgive me for, and maybe you can help educate me a little bit, but I thought warnings were primarily relevant in a marketing defect claim.
They may be more relevant in the science case.
But here you're saying that no matter how, let's say hypothetically, no matter how dangerous a design is, no matter how safe the alternatives are, if you've got a good warning, then the manufacturer wins.
Well, I don't know if I'd go quite that far. Well, I think that's what...
I'm pushing it a little bit.
I know you're... Let me explain. I think that's what comment J basically says to the restatement of torts.
Which has never been adopted. The second part has never been adopted by this court.
I don't know if this court has specifically said that. The Langley case out of Dallas Court of Appeals, I think, adopts it. Several other Supreme Courts around the country have adopted it. The most recent being the District of Columbia Circuit has adopted it in the most recent case. Maryland has adopted it. Kentucky has adopted it.
How do you adopt that comment?
How did they adopt it? No, they just put it in the opinion saying this comment states the law, and this court has adopted that as the law of this state.
So it would be, but in terms of products liability, strict liability, we have manufacturing defects, design defects, and marketing defects,
yes,
and the adequacy of the warning is really a paramount consideration in both marketing and design defects or something.
I believe it is the law of the state of Texas that even in a design defect case that you have to consider the warning, because you have to decide, is this product reasonably safe as a matter, in this case, for this car, as a matter of law.
And the Court of Appeals said that's just one factor.
It is.
Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it is one factor. However, I think if they ignore that factor completely, they ignore the warning completely, they don't even challenge it in the court of, in the trial court, then they can't win by saying, we're going to ignore that one factor. We're going to completely ignore it and say, no matter what kind of a warning you put on there, no matter if you tell us to do all these things, you tell us to stand away from the tire, you tell us to use a gauge, know how much air we're putting in it, no matter what, all those things you tell us, we think we can suggest some kind of design that will prevent your warrant from being any good no matter what.
My question, though, is if it's one factor, how do you weigh the other factors, and who does that?
Well, I think the trial court weighs both factors together. The trier of fact weighs both factors to determine if it is, quote, unquote, reasonably safe. However, if you have two elements of a proof, and they ignore one of them, have no evidence on it whatsoever, it's my opinion that this court can say they completely failed to offer any evidence on the issue of was the warning effective, would this warning have prevented the accident, just like in signs, if the warning would prevent the accident, even if they claim it's inadequate, we're not talking about adequacy here because we don't have an adequacy of warning question before the court because they didn't choose to challenge that in the trial court. My point is, since both of those are elements of a design defect case, and when you look at the product, if it has a warning on it, now that, if there's no warning on the product, it makes it easy for them to, in a design defect case, to say there is no warning here. As a matter of law, there's no warning, therefore we don't have to challenge it. We can show that by putting a different type of device on this machine, it would have made it safer.
Why, though, if they're trying to prove defective design, unreasonably dangerous product, don't they just get to put on how bad the design is and rest? And if the defendant wants to say something about the warning, let them do it.
Well, it's my position.
If everybody stands quiet at that point,
that
the jury entitled to find defective design?
They may be, Your Honor, if two things occur. If number one, there's no warning on there whatsoever, or if, as you say, the defendant stands quiet. We didn't stand quiet in this case. We produced evidence that there was a warning in effect, and they didn't say anything about it being ineffective or bad or anything else.
You are, in this products liability design defect case, you can see that the plaintiff can prove a defective design in the product by doing either that the product as designed is defective or that as designed it should have had a warning and didn't have a warning. So the plaintiff doesn't have to overcome a warning on this product before it gets to the jury.
I think he does if there's a warning on it, Your Honor. If there's a warning on there, I think he has to overcome that issue. At least produce evidence that it's bad.
So your position is no matter how defective the design, that a warning can preclude liability?
Well, don't forget, Your Honor, that we're talking about a misuse situation. I wouldn't say that they're normal use. They're normal use of the product, absolutely not. Normal use of the product, it's got to be properly designed. And there's no dispute here in this case but what this product is perfectly good for the average normal use of the tire. It's only when they misuse it by putting it on a wheel that we did not manufacture, and only in a case where we can't even prevent them from misusing it by any design of the tire.
Well, Counselor, I understand that's what you characterize the case, but I'm sure counsel is going to focus on negligent design, and that's what the jury found, negligent design.
Let me show something, Your Honor. It was undisputed in this case by the plaintiff's expert himself that the tire company could do nothing to prevent the misuse by redesigning the tire. The only people who could prevent the mismatching of these two components is the wheel company. That's their plaintiff's expert's testimony. He specifically said, I don't know of any way that you can change that tire to keep you from matching these two mismatched things together. Now, the wheel company can, by its design, prevent people from buttonholing the tire over the wheel by making the center of the wheel a certain dimension, etc. But because you've got a 16-inch tire and a 16-inch wheel, and because there's rubber around the edges of that bead of that tire, the tire company cannot do anything to prevent them from putting those two together.
But what about the plaintiff's expert testimony that seems to indicate that the stronger bead had been available since the early 1970s and that Goodrich converted to this head in 1991 after other manufacturers had done so?
Well, there is testimony from him to that effect. I don't quite understand.
Doesn't that speak to a negative design?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. Number one, they didn't talk about, and I realize the court didn't grant it on this point, but there's a lot of briefing in the court and in the Court of Appeals about in a negligence case, you've got to talk about processes, et cetera, not, you've got to talk about foreseeability, not just hindsight like you do in a defect case, but assuming the court's correct on that point. The testimony was by everybody that this bead that he's talking about, even though it's been around a while, nobody in any tire company anywhere in the world ever said it's a better bead for this purpose. It just happened to be proven, I wouldn't say proven, but it happened to be suggested in some testing that was done after our tire was manufactured, by the way, by the University of Michigan, that when you get in a mismatch situation, it happens to be that this other bead bursts at a little bit stronger level than the lower bead. Neither one of them are safe anyway. They're still not safe, either one of them. And in the regular situation, when you put them on a regular tire, if you put a 16-inch tire on a 16-inch wheel, with either one of these two beads, they both burst under government testing at about 350 pounds per square inch. They're both equally strong when you put them on the correct tire. So all he's suggesting is that he has found evidence from some testing done in lawsuits later on that suggests that this tire may burst at a higher pressure in a mismatched situation, not in a regular use of the tire.
In a hypothetical case, if the evidence about the adequacy of the warning is undisputed, it was adequate, and the evidence about a safer design is disputed, disputing the evidence, and it goes to the jury, and the jury finds unreasonably dangerous product effectively designed, is that a fact issue? And as long as the evidence is as I've described it, the verdict will support a judgment, or is it a legal question that courts review on appeal?
I think it's a question for the directed verdict because one of the two elements of an unreasonably safe product, that is the warning, was never disputed by the plaintiff. If that's undisputed, then I think the trial court should grant a directed verdict on the basis that there was no evidence. If you're talking about a misuse, which is a rare situation, now, we're not talking about the normal use of the tire. So only if we're talking about a misuse, I think, just like the case out of Maryland that I quoted in our brief was a gasoline can that had instructions on it, do not store in residential areas, keep out of the reach of children. And the plaintiff's experts said, well, they could have made it a little bit safer if they had put a child-proof cap on there in addition to saying keep out of the reach of children. And the Maryland court said, well, but that's a misuse of the product. And even though you might could always make it somewhat safer, that doesn't necessarily make it unreasonably dangerous the way it was. That's what Henderson versus Ford says a long time ago in this state. You don't have to always keep upgrading the safeness of the product if it's reasonably safe to begin with. And if you're talking about a misuse situation and they violated the instructions and warnings about how they were using it, then to say that they had to go one step further and that would overcome the warnings is not the law of this state.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. C. Hastings, and that argument to the respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. The defendants in this case, from the time we tried the case 3.5 years ago until today, keep trying to make the plaintiffs try this case as a failure to warn. It was never tried as a failure to warn. Plaintiffs made the election to try this case as a design defect case. This court, as recently as in Caterpillar versus Shears last year, recognized that there are three different methods of proving a product defect, that be a manufacturing defect, a design defect, or a marketing defect. And the courts have held that a failure to warn is a marketing defect.
And so it's not relevant in a design defect case?
A warning is relevant in a design defect case. It is one of the factors that courts may look to in determining whether or not a design is defective.
Was this warning adequate?
This warning, I never contested the warning. It's a nice warning. The warning does not tell people how to determine if this is a 16-inch wheel that they're dealing with or a 16.5-inch wheel they're dealing with. If you look at the warning, it says never mount on a 16.5-inch rim. But if you can't tell if you're dealing with a 16.5-inch rim or a 16-inch rim, the warning does you no good. The evidence was very clear, Judge Spector, that the individuals involved in doing this work pulled off 16-inch tires from the rim involved in this accident. I brought the rim up here, and two exemplar rims that are, one is a 16 and one is a 16.5. You can look at them.
Uniroyal
did not make these wheels. These wheels have been made since the late 1960s. Uniroyal knew the problem with identifying a 16 and a 16.5 rim.
What evidence is there that the tire is defective for its intended purpose and its normal use?
For normal use, it is fine, except that this type of bead is about 50 years old that they put in the tire. It has had problems since the early 50s. If it hangs up during the mounting process, it can blow up on even a regular wheel, on the right size wheel. But the other question is that a manufacturer has the duty to design a tire for foreseeable misuses, make it safe for foreseeable misuses. The manufacturer, in this case, Goodrich, knew of the problem with the 16.5.
What factors do we take into account in determining whether it's defective?
The factors you take from a design defect standpoint, there are, in fact, the restatement third, the draft list in comment K, there's 10 factors that a court can take into consideration in the design defect case. One of those is warning. One of those is alternative, safer alternative designs that are technically feasible, economically feasible, marketable. What we showed in this case, and that particular comment of the restatement third draft pretty closely follows the 1993 Product Liability Reform Act that was enacted in Texas.
And does that section address product misuse?
The section, I believe it does, but in fact it's illustration 13 under that section, because that section deals with the action. I'm sorry, section 2B is the one that lists all the factors. Section 2K deals with the interaction of a warning and a design defect and how they can work together, and it has an illustration of where a man is working on a garbage truck, and the garbage truck has this warning that says don't stick your feet or your hands in the machinery. But in the process of doing his job, he runs up, jumps on the back of the truck as he's going down the street, as garbage men do, and he loses his balance and he sticks his foot in the machinery and he hurts himself. The restatement third points out that does not preclude, just because there's a warning, that doesn't preclude the design defect. That is a factor to consider, but perhaps they should have had a guard on it, because the warning can't make this man stop or avoid losing his balance.
Do we still take into a risk utility?
Yes, we do take a risk utility.
Who balances those factors?
The jury. Only the jury. What we've showed in this case, as far as the design defect and as far as the effect of the warning, is I brought two. These were exhibits in the trial. One, this bead is the exact same bead as was in the tire that blew up and injured my client. It is called a tape bead. It is made by taking five strands of wire and wrapping it around six or seven times, and finally you get the top of the bead right up here. This is a splice, and it's called a splice, and history has shown and is documented in the evidence that all the way back to 1955, there's a patent application that shows this type of bead has a problem, and it always breaks right at the bottom area of the splice when you get a hang-up. And a hang-up can occur on the right size wheel. A hang-up is what occurs on the mid-size. And these break right there. There's evidence in the record to that effect that that is the problem with the design. There's also evidence in the record that this is called a single-strand bead. This is the bead that Goodrich went to within about 6 months after this accident. They put it in 1991 tire. Our accident happened in 1990. This single-strand bead is made up of one wire wrapped a whole lot of times so that you don't have the hard spot underneath. You don't have that hang-up point and the pressure concentration. That this was all explained in the evidence. This is why this is a better bead and this is a bad bead. What we explained in the evidence was that this 50-year-old bead design has injured many, many people, and that is evidence in the record. This has been recognized as a problem in the mismatch of a 16 on a 16.5 rim since the early 1970s. There is a...
How do you respond to the graphic here or the exhibit that purports to say that your own expert stated that there was no way to design or alter the 16-inch tire so that somebody, by mistake, doesn't try to put it on a 6.5-inch wheel?
The response is...
Did your expert say that?
Yes, my expert said that. But that is tunnel vision on the part of the manufacturer. They say that if we can't prevent this misuse, then we don't have to do anything but warn about it. If they can design to reduce the risk of a misuse, the law says they have to do that.
But what about the argument that if they did design to prevent this misuse, if they did design a different bead for this tire to be put on a 16.5 tire or rim, it would be potentially hazardous under those circumstances?
That is a jury question in the balancing. The response is that this tape bead that they use has hurt many people in mismatched situations. This ribbon bead or single-strand bead, single-strand bead, has never injured anyone in a mismatched situation. It has never injured anyone out on the highway being used. It has been in use by other manufacturers since the late 1970s by Goodyear, Yokohama, General Tire. They all switched to this bead. If this truly poses an increased risk of harm because of this of a danger in use, why did they switch to it? These are questions that a jury gets to answer in the balancing of the utility of the design. We presented both of these bead options to the jury. We presented all of the arguments this court is considering and wondering in your minds, and the jury said the design is defective. What the defendant wants to do is convert comment J of the restatement of tort second from a presumption that people will follow an adequate warning and they will heed it, and that supplies the causation link for a failure to warn case. They want to change that rebuttable presumption in comment J into a conclusive presumption. This court has never held that comment J is a conclusive presumption. If a plaintiff comes in and says, if they'd have put a better warning on it, I would have followed it. This court has noted that in the signs case and said it is a rebuttable presumption. If the manufacturer can show, well, if we'd have put a better warning on it, that's nice and fine, but this individual plaintiff can't read. Or in the signs case, it was there, it was obvious, nobody ever paid any attention to it, they never read it. So how could it be a cause?
Is it true in this case that if the warning had been followed, the accident would not occur?
If the warning had been followed, the accident would not have occurred, except that no one, my client and the person he was working with, felt that they were following the warning. The problem with the warning is, as I pointed out, you can't tell whether this is a 16 or this is a 16.
They felt they were following a warning even though they didn't have it mounted in the safety stand. They weren't using the clip-on chuck, and they weren't not leaning over the assembly.
The employer didn't provide a clip-on chuck. The tire machine that was out there was broken. It didn't work. People have been, the evidence was, people have been changing tires on the ground as long as they've been out there.
Well, I didn't even know any of these machines existed, but nevertheless, you said they felt they were following the warning, and just looking at all the yellow parts.
In the manner that they were doing it, those are not a complete defense of a product's case. those are allegations that can be made of contributory negligence, allegations that they did make in the trial court that the jury considered and found, no, that Mr. Martinez was not contributorily negligent. They are not total defenses to a products liability case.
Why isn't it a defense to say in a warning, whatever you do, whether you can tell or you can't tell, whether no matter what the circumstances are, don't air up this tire unless it's in a cage?
The problem with that being a warning is, and a total defense is, people in the real world don't always have a cage to put it in. Mr. Martinez, in this case, did not have a cage to put it in. So he's left out there with this product they've designed that has a design defect in it that could prevent his accident. He's forced to go to work anyway, and the manufacturer can sit back and say, well, I sold a defective product, but it's too bad. The problem with the warning was pointed out real clearly by defense counsel in the trial. Let me say this one more time. To crack the code on a 16.5-inch wheel is extremely difficult. Nobody in this case was able to do so. Either management or the employees of Harris had any idea as to how you were supposed to find that incredibly poorly marked, vague, almost hidden size designation. No one has the slightest idea that that is a 16.5-inch wheel, and we will show the jury this morning how hard it is to find it. They want the defense of this warning they put on there, but their own counsel admits that you can't comply with the warning because you can't tell if this is a 16 or a 16.5-inch rim.
Why is that not a defect on the part of the manufacturer of the wheel as opposed to the tire?
That is an allegation of defect on the part of the manufacturer of the wheel, and we sued the manufacturer of the wheel. They settled their claim. The jury concluded that the jury failed to find that the wheel was defective. Goodrich submitted special issues on whether or not the design of the wheel was defective. They didn't submit it on a warning case theory. They submitted on a design defect, and the jury failed to find it.
Was there anybody to defend, to present the issue?
They raised up the tortfeasor, and Goodrich took the credit of their money.
I understand, but yes. In terms of inform the jury to defend the validity of the wheel, was there anybody to speak for the wheel or for the company that produced it?
No. Oh. Goodrich had a free shot at
so the wheel. Is it surprising that the jury found that this was not defective?
It didn't surprise me or not surprise me. I argued the wheel wasn't the real problem, that the tire was the real problem, because this wheel was made in 1979. The tire was made in 1990. The last company with an opportunity to avoid this injury was the people that made the tire in 1990. The wheel problem that Goodrich has known about since the wheels came out. This wheel, I guarantee you could. In fact, there's evidence in the record that the employer spent a full day with this wheel and never could figure out what size it was. That's in the record. And that's why my client could not tell that he was not following the warning. Because he thought he was.
Let's assume that's the problem. The problem is that you've got wheels that you can't tell the size on. Going back to Uniroyal's argument, they could have put a stronger bead on here, but they would have still mounted on a 16.5-inch rim, and depending on how much air they put into it, it would have blown up.
The response to that is that in this case in particular, the compressor out of the work site didn't go up to a high enough air pressure to blow up a single strand bead. The evidence in the record from the witnesses was that the air compressor would go up to between 80 and 120 pounds. The lowest pressure a single strand bead has ever broken at in a mismatch situation is 130 pounds. The experts for the defendant agreed that if that is true, that the compressor would only go to 120, this accident would never have happened with a single strand bead. The representative of the defendant agreed that if this accident happened at 100 pounds per square inch, which is what the defendant's expert testified it happened at, the accident would not have happened with a single strand bead. There was conflicting evidence as to the pressure, because my expert said he thought it happened around 50. The witnesses on the scene of the accident said there's no way that there was 100 pounds of pressure in the tire at the time of the explosion, that it was closer to 60. But even taking the defendant's position that it was all the way up to 100, That is not enough to break a single strand bead.
In this case, but in other cases it would.
In other cases, there has never been a person injured by any other manufacturer's tire that uses a single strand bead in any way, shape, or form. They have never been injured on the road. They have never been injured in a mismatch. This single strand bead is a very good, real cure to the problem that this tape piece poses. That is what the evidence in the record was. That is the question for the jury to determine. Since there's evidence in the record of our position that it's a bad design, that the tape is a bad design, plenty of evidence to support that. The defendant's position is, no, it's a good design, you're going to pose a new risk. That's a jury question. That's not a question of law at all. It's a jury question, and the jury answered that question already. The Court of Appeals affirmed that question.
Was there some evidence that this could, the other design that you were advocating, can explode if enough pressure is put in the tire in a mismatch situation?
It can explode. The lowest it's ever exploded at is 130 pounds per square inch. It goes all the way from 130 up over to around 300 pounds per square inch in a mismatch situation. There's evidence in the record.
Did the respondent put on evidence that this mismatch could have caused an accident on some other occasion, some other occurrence after the car was being driven?
The respondent called a witness named Tom Connor, who testified. He had done some testing for standard testing laboratories and mismatched on purpose wheels and put them on his machines and drove them, and they suffered catastrophic failures later on. You know, 5,000, 6,000 miles.
I guess my
road.
Question is, this may or may not be the case. I don't want to get into that, but there certainly could be cases where an alteration that would have been safer for the parties that are in litigation in one instance might create a danger somewhere else.
And is that
a balance for a jury to make or a court, or do we just say to manufacturers, you choose and pay?
That is
whoever gets hurt.
That is precisely a question for the jury. Restatement K, comment K of the third restatement even talks about that being one of the factors.
Well, this restatement third is all fine and good, but I doubt the jury was instructed.
They were not.
In restatement
and the
third.
Only reason I refer to it is this court referred to it in Caterpillar versus Shear. The jury is instructed under the pattern jury charge with a definition of unreasonably dangerous, balancing the utility of the product with the risk it imputes. The expert I just referred to that said that this posed a new danger out in the real world when people use these tires in mismatches also agreed that if it was his loved one down there putting air in this wheel with a mismatch situation, he would want a single strand bead.
But at some point, a court may have to make a judgment that a manufacturer who wants to make tires and is faced with this problem,
At some point,
there has to be some judgments made that people cannot be liable for either choice they make. I mean, you have a choice to make, you've got to make the choice, and what you're saying is in individual cases it can result in liability when it injures somebody on that occasion, and there's no overarching policy choice that can be made. We just look at each individual situation in isolation, in the abstract, and whichever way you choose, you lose down the road.
Well, the overarching policy consideration that I believe is in place is the jury. And the jury looks at all of the evidence for the design change and against the design change.
But when we review it on appeal, we just look in isolation at that instant. And even if the proof were using the multi-strand bead caused one accident every 1,000 times and using a single strand caused one accident every 10. So even if the choice not taken was much more dangerous, our job as a reviewing court just to look at this instance in isolation, if there's some evidence to support it, we have to uphold the verdict.
That's correct.
And we can't worry about the next, I mean, next week if another case comes where the other choice was made and there's some evidence to support that, we uphold that verdict as well.
That is what the Constitution provides this court with the power to do and limits this court to a no evidence review.
And that's just for jurors maybe to say, well, there was a greater social good here in making the choice that was made, so we'll give no compensation to this catastrophically
injured
situation. Any other questions?
I'm glad the council mentioned.
On the other hand, is Unirol suggesting that we weigh that evidence?
Well, actually, Your Honor, what I'm suggesting is that that evidence brings up the fact that you can't always produce the safest product in the world for every situation. And I think the Shears case that council referred to was, my recollection is, was a case where the expert testimony was that you could make it where they couldn't take off the protective devices. And the court's conclusion was, well, you can always make something safer, but that doesn't mean it's not reasonably safe the way it was. My position is that that's why the warning is important even in a defect case. Because you can always say you could do this, you could do that.
Well, there's no question it's important, but for you it has to be conclusive, doesn't it?
In a misuse situation, if they produce no evidence that the warning is bad, I think it's conclusive. Now, that's my position.
Well, what about their argument that even with an extremely effective warning, that is not an absolute, as a matter of law, defense? It is merely evidence of contributory negligence on the plaintiff's part by not following it, which is something that should be left to the hands of the jury.
I think that argument becomes apparent, Your Honor, in cases where, like the garbage truck that he mentioned, or the meat slicer or the punch press, where the worker or the person involved in it can inadvertently just automatically get their hand and foot in the device, and the testimony is that warning doesn't do any good there. You can't keep them from slipping and putting their foot in there by warning against it. But that's where the language in Sions and the San Antonio Court of Appeals case of Gillespie versus Century Products that follows Sions comes up, when they say basically that in those kinds of cases, well, in all cases really, there is a presumption that the warning will do some good, that the warning will prevent the accident. But in those cases, the plaintiff's expert can very easily say the warning doesn't. The presumption is not valid in a case like a punch press or a meat slicer or a garbage truck. The presumption just doesn't apply in those cases because it's a momentary inadvertent slip.
But those are marketing defect cases, aren't they? They're not design defect cases.
No, a lot of times they are design defect cases, aren't they? Now, I know that Signs and Gillespie were marketing cases. Yes, that's what the court asked. But I'm saying a lot of times cases like the meat slicer or with having a guard on it, et cetera, is a design defect case. But they can. It's very easy to say in those cases, and the same rule applies, that is, there is a presumption that the warning will make a difference, whether it's a defect case or a market case. And if that presumption doesn't apply because it's a meat slicer, because it's a garbage truck, and those are not marketing cases, those are design defect cases, the garbage truck. But the presumption doesn't apply there because it's a momentary slip. Here we're not talking about a momentary slip. And counsel's statement that you can't comply with the warning here does not hold any water whatsoever. You maybe it's hard to comply with the warning about not mismatching a 16 or 16.5. I can't tell the difference in a 9/16-inch bolt and a half-inch bolt when I'm trying to put a nut on a bolt either. But it quickly becomes apparent if I'm doing it the right way that it doesn't fit. If I keep putting a wrench on there and tightening and tightening and tightening, it's not going to fit after a while. They're told in these instances, and they're warned in these instances, that if you keep putting it on there and you keep adding air to it, number one, it's probably going to break, but number two, you better stand back away from it. Not only is it warned, the undisputed testimony in this case is that the plaintiff himself knew that. He testified unequivocally, I know you're not supposed to lean over one of these tires. And not just because of a mismatch, it's just because tire changing is a dangerous procedure.
Does this warning address the question of, or tell the reader how to distinguish a 16-inch rim from a 16.5-inch rim?
No, no, it does not go into how you measure it. It just says don't do it. And then there really is no way to eyeball it. It says don't do it, number one, and then if you follow these procedures, nothing's going to happen to you even if you do that. That's what I'm saying.
What cases are you aware of that an effective warning conclusively established that the defendant was not liable in a negligent design case?
First one was Lange versus Procter & Gamble, the Dallas Court of Appeals a long time ago in Texas. The second one would be the recent case out of the D.C. Circuit, Ferguson versus Winkler, involving a bakery conveyor belt where they were warned not to take the guard off not to take the guard off and not to put their hand in the conveyor belt while it was moving, and they took the guard off and put their hand in while it was moving, and there was testimony that they could have designed around that by some type of electric eye or whatever that they could stop them from going in there, and the court said they're warned not to do that, they did it anyway even though you might could have done something about it. There's a Kentucky case called Ulrich versus I'll try to put these in a post-submission brief.
I was going to say, would each side provide a post-submission argument on that?
But the Kentucky case involved a grinding wheel that's made out of aggregate, and as the court may know, in some other cases, those at certain RPM, those will fly apart. And the court said if they were not to exceed 2,000 RPM, they did it anyway. You could make one that would withstand 2,500 RPM, but that they could exceed that also, just like in this case, they can exceed lots of PSI if they just keep... Man didn't even have an air gauge, so how's he going to know how much air is in there? They said, oh, it couldn't have been over 100 PSI. There was no way for them to know that. You can't tell by looking at a tire once you get up to about 30 pounds how much air is in it. So they had no idea knowing how much air was in it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the second call, and the court will take another brief recess.
All rise.